As a film work of art, this takes precedence over anything that has so far been produced. It makes worthy pictures of the past look like tinsel shams. It fills one with since intense admiration that other pictures appear but trivial in comparison. It is the gifted performance of Falconetti as the Maid of Orleans that rises above anything in this artistic achievement. Mordaunt Hall, The New York Times. It is a film that has been butchered by clergymen, the French government, and banned in Britain. It has been lost and rediscovered. This is Carl Theodor Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. You're listening to Film Survey with J.G. Murphy. I am your host, J.G. Every week, we explore the history and themes of some of the greatest films in cinema history. But instead of randomly picking films week in and week out, we look at a certain theme and multiple films that are linked by that theme, sort of like a college course. Our first section is Vive la France, French filmmakers and the story of France. This week, we examine the 1928 silent film, The Passion of Joan of Arc. This show is part of the TMK Pictures family of podcasts. For more content, please visit our website, www.tmkpictures.com, and our YouTube channel. Just look for the green clover. The story of The Passion of Joan of Arc is certainly a roller coaster. I would be lying if I said I wasn't looking forward to this episode. And I'm so glad the Criterion Channel exists, making this and countless other great films available for streaming. No, I'm not getting sponsored for saying that. It's what I truly believe. But before we get into the film itself, let's take a look at Carl Theodor Dreyer. Dreyer was born in Copenhagen, Denmark, a fact that will later prove to hurt The Passion of Joan of Arc. His birth mother was an unmarried Scanian maid named Josephine Bernhardine Nielsen, and he was put up for adoption by his birth father, Jens Christian Torp, a married Danish farmer living in Sweden. Torp happened to employ Dreyer's mother at his farm, making Dreyer an illegitimate child. Sound familiar? At the age of two, Dreyer was adopted by Carl Theodor and Inger Marie Dreyer. According to Danish practice, senior and junior are not added to the names to distinguish one from the other. So, Dreyer shared his adoptive father's name. Dreyer did not have a happy childhood, later recalling that his parents, quote, constantly let me know that I should be grateful for the food I was given and that I strictly had no claim on anything, since my mother got out of paying by lying down to die. In the 19-teens, Dreyer found himself writing title cards for silent films at Norsdic Film. As the 1920s came about, Dreyer began directing such films as The Parson's Widow, Leaves from Satan's Book, and Master of the House. Each of his first eight films saw limited success, and he decided to move to France to join the industry there. When he arrived, he met the likes of Jean Cocteau and Jean Hugo. The Société Générale de Film invited Dreyer to make a film, and he pitched ideas about Marie Antoinette, Catherine de' Medici, and Joan of Arc. The production company and Dreyer eventually decided on the project by drawing matches. Joan of Arc won. Joan was a smart choice for the time, given how topical she was. After the Great War, Joan was canonized as a saint of the Roman Catholic Church and adopted as one of the patron saints of France. She symbolizes bravery and continues to remain a popular figure in all forms of art. Dreyer spent over a year and a half carefully researching the life of Joan, basing the script off of the original transcript of her trial and execution. He condensed 18 months and 29 interrogations into one 90-minute film. Joseph Deltille's book, Jeanne d'Arc, was also credited as a source, though nothing of his book was used in the finished film. Now that the writing stage was completed, Dreyer needed to find his heroine. He attended a performance of Victor Marguerite's La Garçonne, starring Renée Jeannet Falconetti. Dreyer was unimpressed, but decided to return the next day. It was during his second viewing that he saw something in Falconetti that he felt he could tap into and get the performance he needed for the film. He asked her to do some screen tests, without makeup. The tests sold him on the idea, and he offered the part to Falconetti. Falconetti, on the other hand, secretly hoped that she would not have to cut her hair or forego makeup. In the end, her head was shaven, and she displayed a bare face. Dreyer was a reported tyrant on the set, and famously treated Falconetti harshly. He would make her kneel on painful stone and omit any and all emotion from her face. He would do take after take after take of the same shot. If he was having difficulties explaining himself to her, Dreyer would turn bright red and stammer. The film's release was delayed due to the efforts of many French nationalists to halt the release entirely. They did not like the fact that Dreyer was neither French nor Catholic. Therefore, they thought he could not do Joan of Arc justice. Before its premiere, the Archbishop of Paris and government censors made extensive cuts to the film. In December of 1928, the original negative was destroyed in a fire in Berlin, to which only a few copies existed. Dreyer made a second cut of the film with alternate and unused takes. That version was also destroyed in a lab fire in 1929. As time marched on, it became increasingly difficult to find copies of either version. In 1951, Joseph-Marie Leduca found a copy of Dreyer's second cut and made significant changes. Among them were the addition of a Baroque score and replacing many intertitles with subtitles. Despite Dreyer's objection, this version was the only one available for many years. In 1981, an employee of the Dijkmark Hospital, a mental institution in Oslo, came across several film canisters in a janitor's closet, labeled as The Passion of Joan of Arc. The canisters were sent to the Norwegian Film Institute and examined 3 years later. Remarkably, this turned out to be Dreyer's original cut before the government and church censorship. No one knows how the copy wound up in Oslo, but film historians believe that the director of the institution may have requested a special copy, given that he himself was a published historian. That copy is what is available today for your viewing pleasure. Well, that was indeed a strange and long history. But, I gotta say, I'm glad the original film was eventually found. Whatever it was critics originally saw and praised back in 1928 cannot hold a candle to the film that exists today. In its simplest form, The Passion of Joan of Arc is a story about hypocrisy, conformity, and the consolidation of power. Dreyer, a Protestant, probably had issues with the papacy and the Catholic Church as a whole. Now, before I go any further, I would like to state this. This episode in no way is trying to make a case against the Catholic Church or religion as a whole. The thoughts I will express are merely to figure out what Dreyer's message is. My personal thoughts on religion are my own, and I do not want to turn this into a discussion of faith. So please, if you are to send me any of your own insights or comments, let's make sure they are focused on the film at hand. Thank you. In order to understand, let's explore the way in which Dreyer makes the film look. The cinematography in this film is claustrophobic, and I mean that in the best way possible. It is deliberately claustrophobic, and is shot primarily in extreme close-ups. Not only does this give the film a certain intimacy, but it puts the audience in the place of its heroine. Joan feels the walls closing in on her as these men berate her and tell her how naive she is. They want to make her feel small, and Dreyer conveys this by mainly shooting Falconetti from above and pointing the camera downward. In contrast, most of the clergymen are shot from below, pointing upward. This gives them a sense of untouchability. They are above her. They are closer to heaven than her. Or so they think. Our story continues in a moment. And now, back to the show. The cinematography gives way to the power dynamic in the film, and Dreyer's comments on the consolidation of power as it relates to the church. For centuries, only priests could read and interpret the Bible, maintaining the idea that only they could have a higher connection to God. While the reason for trying Joan was because she wore men's clothes, against the law back then, it is clear that Dreyer is making the case they were more enraged at the fact that she spoke to God directly. Questions concerning the look of St. Michael, if he was naked, if he had a halo, the way they were taught he should look, only gives more agency to this idea. For them, it is all about control. They cannot let people think that some country girl is deemed more worthy of God than they are. They must maintain the illusion that they alone can speak to God in order to control the masses. If people start thinking anyone can talk to God, you invite free thinking, always a danger to an oligarchy and a theocracy. That is why it is so important for the clergy to denounce her, and why they constantly tell her she is a steward of the devil. There are two major tools that those in power use to maintain their standing: deception and intimidation. They continually try to deceive Joan to get her to think they are actually on her side. This is evident when one particular priest claims he believes her and presents to her a forged letter signed by King Charles, telling her to believe the priest. The hope is that she will tell him the truth, or rather what they want to hear. Then they try to intimidate her. They show her their instruments of torture in an effort to pull a confession out of her. At first, it works. She signs a confession saying she did not receive a message from God and that she is guilty of wearing men's clothes. However, she later recants. She cannot tell a lie, even if it means losing her life. Perhaps she is closer to God than they are, seeing as how she stays true to herself. The clergy, on the other hand, are only concerned with power. They are greedy for it, and there is no way a 19-year-old girl will get in their way. Though she has been given great knowledge, knowledge is power, and only the few in the church deem it appropriate that they possess that power. They continue to intimidate later in the film. While Joan is being burned at the stake, many onlookers show their support for her. This leads to the prison guards attacking the onlookers, punishing them for speaking up in defense of Joan. It is a common theme throughout the film. Those who come to her defense are routinely silenced. It is another issue Dreyer seems to be bringing to light: conformity. Everyone must think the same, do the same, pray to the same God. In the initial trial, two priests try to make a case that Joan is telling the truth and that there is no reason to think she is lying. One is escorted out of the room, the other is shouted to silence. It is clear that the church was intent on punishing Joan no matter what. You either get in line or risk suffering the same fate. All of this feeds into the hypocrisy of the church. It is almost self-explanatory. The Catholic Church murdered this 19-year-old girl because she claimed to receive a message from God. Then they turn around and proclaim her a martyr and a saint nearly 500 years later. Yet, no apology was given. They did not recognize their own misdeeds. And now they glorify her as one of the purest people to ever live. In reality, her execution was political, as the bishop who condemned her was pro-English. and perhaps Dreyer is disgusted at the political nature of her death in the name of God. For those who are students of the Bible, God is not partial to a single country. Perhaps something Dreyer felt to his core. The acting in this film is something to marvel at. Falconetti is truly incredible and raw in this performance. It is absolutely heartbreaking to watch as we, the audience, get a sense that she truly is just a young woman trying to do the right thing. Her gaze is often haunting, as if she is in a trance, perhaps receiving messages from God at all times. Dreyer played it smart. He didn't want Falconetti to wear any makeup. He wanted this film to look real, as if the audience is transported back to the 15th century. There is no inkling of glamour, because this period in history was not a glamorous time. It also strips away anything superfluous, so that we only focus on Falconetti and her performance. We get to see her as she is, not as an actor, but as a person trying to fight for her life. In recent years, music has become a lot more important to silent films than just one person sitting down at a piano. A choir sings disturbing melodies that are foreboding, foreshadowing the tragic end of the martyr. One scene that will stay etched in my mind is the disturbing sequence of Joan being burned at the stake. It is so visceral, so real, it's horrifying to watch. Dreyer lingers the camera on Joan, forcing us to watch her burn. It is a common thread among filmmakers. You have the audience trapped as it is. You might as well force them to reckon with the bloody history of human civilization. I could not find any articles on how they achieved the look of it, so if any of you know, please share. I'd be lying if I said this film was fun to watch. It is a depressing walk to an inevitable end. Nonetheless, it is riveting. If you like films that make you angry, this will be one for you, and it is easy to see why this film was so influential. Just as with Napoleon, this film's use of close-ups was revolutionary for its time. The rest of the world recognized the power of that shot and began using it more and more. I'd still venture to say that The Passion of Joan of Arc uses more close-ups than even today's modern movies. Next week, we will continue our exploration of French history through film with Céline Sciamma's 2019 historical fiction, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. I know, I said we'd cover Les Misérables, but I came across this film and thought it would be more interesting to talk about this rather than a story we are all very familiar with. Thank you for stopping by on this week's episode of Film Survey. This show is researched, written, and hosted by myself, J.G. Murphy, and is part of the TMK Pictures family of podcasts. If you would like to view a transcription of this episode, it will be available on thefilmsurveypodcast.com. If you would like to share your thoughts with me on this film, make sure to follow at Film Survey Podcast on Instagram, or you could shoot me a message at thejgmurphy on Twitter. You can also email me directly at jgmurphy@tmkpictures.com. It is possible I may share your thoughts with the rest of the community. I host another podcast, Obscurities of the Silver Screen, with my dear friend and colleague, Remy Gray. Episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. Please be sure to check out more of TMK's content, including Space Stuff, Look Ma No Helmet, and Inner Idiot Child. All shows are free to watch on TMK's YouTube channel. Just look for the Green Clover. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to next week's discussion.